Chapter 5. Pride Before Victory. Jaime had known almost to the day when Tyrion had reached the wall. Varys had nearly 30 spies at Castle Black alone now, although the exact number rose and fell. Many of them inconveniently kept running away, either frightened off by what was apparently a truly determined commitment to the story on Stark's part, or just fed up with the ludicrous things he was demanding of his men. Because it turned out Robb was using the nonsense to turn the wildlings into an army. Not surprisingly, if you thought about it, convincing everyone that a gigantic army of the dead was coming for them had got them all drilling like mad. They were going at it 8 hours of every day, despite limited rations and no liquor. Robb even had them manning the keeps now, all the abandoned fortresses along the wall, the perfect preparation for holding captured ones once they finally marched south, which he'd have to do fairly soon, whether his father was hostage or not, because otherwise his grain was going to run out after all. The Tyrells had taken the king in the hand over the king in the north. They'd arrived at the capital roughly at the same time Tyrion made it to the wall, so now every morning Jaime casually went by the rookery and asked what had come in overnight, even though he knew that any letter Tyrion sent was going to end with, "And give my love to Joffrey." And when Jaime had made sure that nothing had come, he went down to the Solar and made nice with Olenna Tyrell and her descendants, all of whom he'd gladly have pitched out the nearest window, if only he didn't expect to very soon need their 100,000 men and wagons full of grain. The marriage took place after only a week, with as little pomp as the Tyrells would settle for. Robert's taste for elaborate and expensive festivities had gone, along with his drinking. He glowered over the feast tables with a face of stone, and left Cersei to bring any kind of merriment to the occasion. Jaime didn't think he'd ever seen her so happy. She made a glowing figure of grace in the hall, resplendent in a carefully chosen gown of Lannister gold and Baratheon blue, and full of carefully measured condescension to their new princess and her family, whom she made clear had been brought to heel as much as raised up. "Good riddance," was all she'd said when Jaime had spoken to her about Tyrion leaving. "That's another good turn Robb Stark has done us. If he'll only manage to get himself murdered, I'll count him a veritable benefactor of the realm." Varys was doing his best to help Stark along, but it was proving difficult to get anyone close to Robb with any real opportunity. And all the more so thanks to that ox woman Tyrion had traveled with. Apparently Brienne of Tarth fancied herself a king's guard now, for Stark, and she'd organized a dozen other men to be sure he was never left alone, day or night. Not to mention the wolf, which Varys's agents kept claiming had gotten still bigger in every fresh report. "How big has the beast grown now?" Jaime asked him sourly, when Varys came to join him on the edge of the terrace, watching the revelers in the garden court whirling in their dance, Cersei leading the set with Loras Tyrell. "Or was there any originality in today's excuses?" "I have received no word from the wall today, my lord, I am sorry to say," Varys said. "I will be sure to tell you at once if I do." Meaning he'd noticed Jaime checking for messages. "Of course, you must be concerned for your brother. It has been interesting seeing who chooses to go north. Quite unpredictable, to be honest." "Tyrion's gone to get us more information we can trust," Jaime said. "Has he?" Varys said in an inquiring tone. "Perhaps he has. Still unexpected. Among others." There was a hard emphasis to the final words, and Jaime belatedly realized that Varys meant someone new in particular, and was literally interrupting the wedding celebration to tell him about it. "Who is it?" "Lord Stannis took ship from Dragonstone 3 days ago with, as far as I can tell, every man in his service," Varys said. "There's no one left in the keep but a handful of servants." As it turned out, Stannis hadn't sneaked off after all. The raven he'd sent arrived the very next morning, a letter addressed to Robert. "They're not coming south, because if they were, they'd have marched by now," he'd written bluntly. "Either half the north have lost their minds, or there's something coming at the wall. And if there's something coming at the wall, it's the duty of every man in the realm to fight it. So I'm going. If I find it's nonsense or treason, I'll put a stop to it. But I don't believe it, because if Stark were a liar, he'd have told you a better one. If you take my counsel, you'll send the queen and the children to Dragonstone and get Lord Eddard out of that cell you've put him in and march north with him as quick as you can." Robert was nearly purple with rage. Jamie expected to feel the same way, and instead felt only strangely hollow. He'd said, the words coming easily, without effort, "Robb Stark's offered to marry his daughter and take the throne with her, now that Margaery's married to Joffrey." And watched, with a sensation of queasy unreality, as all the heads around the table nodded in agreement, as if he and they were all performing lines in a play. He stayed in the small council chamber long after everyone else had gone, and then he slowly got up and went downstairs, all the way downstairs, to the empty corridor that led to Eddard Stark's cell. It was empty now, because no guard assigned the duty of watching him lasted more than a week anymore, before simply never coming back to work. After three rounds of replacements, Jaime had tried putting two hand-picked Lannister men he'd personally fought with, men who owed him their places, men with families. And after 6 days, one of them came to him twitching and shivering and said he couldn't go back for the love of the Seven, and the other had vanished like all the rest. Varys had later turned him up on the road going north. They even had to have a different kitchen servant take Stark his meals every day, and it was being used as punishment duty by the cooks. The chill thread of blowing air only got colder since the last time Jaime had stopped in to see Eddard. Jaime had to force himself down the dark corridor, and the wall under his groping hand was frosted with cold. He had a lantern, the flickering gleam of it struggling to hold off the dark, and he sucked in his breath when it fell on Stark's hunched shoulders. His head bowed over his hands, his manacled arms braced against his knees, as if there were something impossibly heavy resting on his back that he had to support. In the dim, flickering light, he might have been a statue carved from the stone walls. He looked bigger than he should have, and gray. He didn't look up or speak. Jaime desperately wanted to say something at first. Then he desperately didn't want to say anything because Stark might have answered. And then Jaime just as desperately wanted him to say it and broke the silence. "Your son's made an alliance with Stannis," he said harshly. "He's going to marry Shireen. Clever of him." No answer came. Stark wasn't going to speak, Jaime thought, and wavered helplessly between fury and relief. And then Ned said distantly, "He's promised." "I'm afraid Margaery's thought better of it," Jaime said, still wavering. It wasn't what he'd expected, what he'd feared, what he'd wanted, a demand or an order. Go north and answer the call. "She married Joffrey yesterday." "He's promised," Ned repeated, as if that was all that mattered, and went silent again. He didn't say anything more. It was easier to do the work, knowing there was hope on the other side of it, but that didn't make the work any less, and the hope couldn't give a man skills he didn't have, or bring dragon glass out of the air. They were trying to find any way they could use the tiniest pieces of the tiny hoard Tyrion Lannister had brought with him. But even though the dragon glass was potent no matter the size of it, it was hard to use the smaller pieces. If they embedded it into clubs, it broke. If they wired a piece atop a dagger or a sword or spearhead, it fell off. "Maybe we're better off just making as many spears as we can," John suggested, after another 5 pieces had been crumbled beyond using. They stood in the training yard, looking over a table's worth of attempts that was all their smiths could contrive.
"Snow's not wrong," Sir Alistair said grudgingly. "We could put 6 men on each one, a man to use the spear, the others to make openings for him to use it."
Rob shook his head, not in disagreement, only in frustration.
"You're both not wrong, but it won't be enough."
He picked up a handful of gravel from the yard and spilled it on the table, spreading it in a vast mass, and picked out 1 white pebble to put on the other side, and a couple of twigs to stand in for their own tiny force. "If they divide their army to come at every keep, there will be 100,000 of them at each one. By the 2nd time, at most, the walkers will understand what we mean to do. They'll have the whites swarm us when we sortie out. It's a narrow path we'll be treading. We'll have to keep in tight formation, piercing through, letting them encircle us so long as we keep going." He made an arrow point of the twigs and thrust it into the mass of gravel and left it there. "The whites will press in on us on every side. If we can't kill them fast enough on the leading edges to make room for us to advance, they'll smother the whole force. We must have men armed with dragon glass along those edges. I don't think we can afford to have men with ordinary blades around them. If we spread out too much, the whites will drive in between us. If we stay too close and foul each other, we won't work quick enough. And no matter what we do, they'll be picking men off the whole time. I don't think we can get through with less than 1,000 men, and I'd rather have 2. And we've only enough dragon glass for 500 spears."
"We've brought enough for 20,000, a man said behind him crisply, and Rob straightened to find a stranger had come into the yard at their backs, a man of middle years, tall and lean, with still dark hair retreating from the crown of his head. A handful of knights flanked him, and a woman dressed in deep red. Jory had come in with them, his eyes bright with excitement and urgency.
"Milord," he said, "this is Lord Stannis of Dragonstone. He's come with men and wagons of dragon glass."
Rob stared at him, then jerked his gaze round to Stannis, who had come closer to study the arrangement of pebbles.
"That's greatly welcome indeed, my lord, as are you," he said. "Though I confess..."
"You're surprised I came," Stannis said. "Shouldn't be. You'd been up here too long by the time we sailed. Unless you were stupid, you'd have marched south after 1 month if you'd meant to. I've told Robert so. I don't know if he'll believe me."
He indicated the pebbles, moving a finger from them to the narrow wedge between the sticks.
"They're going to outnumber us that badly?"
"Worse," Rob said. "They'll have that many at every castle along the wall, if they want to, and the defense at each one will have to hold until a sortie force can reach them. But if you brought so much dragon glass, we'll be able to arm 5 such forces and spread them out."
He spoke aloud, already thinking. "It'll be the trained cavalry in shorter supply, then. We've been drilling as many of the good riders as we can."
"I've 5,000 horses with me," Stannis said, "and another 5,000 pikemen. Why's Green Guard empty?"
Rob was caught off guard, both by the good news and the bad.
"What?" he said, bewildered.
"We landed at Eastwatch, marched here along the wall, 1 keep to the next," Stannis said. 2 of them were held by men who know what they're doing, and 1 more by a man who doesn't, but'll learn in time. The rest wouldn't have. I left him my master at arms, and replaced all the others with trained knights. You chose well. Sensible men. They knew as well as I did they weren't up to the work. Didn't put up a fuss. We'll need to do the same for the keeps to the west. But Green Guard's empty. I thought you were leaving a weak point to lure them all through at one place. A stupid idea, but the sort of thing someone might think was clever."
He jerked his head to the arrangement.
"But that's not stupid, and neither is anything else you've done. So why is it empty?"
"Lord Bolton was at Green Guard," John said, looking at Rob, bewildered. "Why would he leave?"
Rob couldn't speak, frozen sick with terror, because that wasn't the question that mattered. The question that mattered was where.
Where had Lord Bolton gone when he'd quietly taken his men and marched away from Castle Black 3 weeks ago? And Rob didn't need to ask the question because he knew the answer. "Jory," he managed. "Jory, go send a raven to Winterfell at once. Tell Bran he must. But the words were dying in his throat because he knew it was too late. Lord Bolton would have arrived 3 days ago, and Rob had stripped the keep. He'd ordered Bran to strip the keep, send him every last fighting man. "Bran's only a boy," John said. "Bolton wouldn't..." But he trailed off. Rob shook his head tight with rage and fear. Stannis flicked a hand in slight impatience. "No sense in worrying about that. The boy's a valuable hostage. No reason to hurt him. No sense in worrying about Winterfell either. If Bolton clears the way and Robert marches north, he'll be coming right that way. He might even get here in time to do some good after all. For now, Green Guard's what matters." He paused and then added levelly, "And we need to discuss the matter of the command." His meaning was plain enough. John stiffened at once, and Rob put a hand out towards him with a shake of his head to forestall him. "Lord Stannis," he said, "my father's spoken of you to me. I know you're an experienced commander of great renown and skill, but a Stark must answer when the Night's King rides, and that's me. And if I fall, it must be another Stark after me. If that's not something you can endure, then I'll still take with gratitude whatever you'll give me to aid us before you leave. But I beg you to accept it and stay." Stannis looked unimpressed. "Why does it have to be a Stark?" Rob stared at him. He didn't have an answer. He only knew it, deep as bone. "I don't know," he said finally. "It's true, but I don't know the reason." "Then you don't know enough," Stannis said. "Understand me, Stark. I don't want to put your back up. You've done well. Better than well, considering what you had. In 2 months' time, you've turned a ragged horde into a serviceable army, and you've manned all the abandoned keeps and got some sort of defense up at all of them. Most good commanders who could give you 20 years couldn't have done as much."
"My mother likes to say, when there's too much sauce, it means the meat is bitter," Rob said, dry.
But your men don't have proper discipline, your drill's a sloppy mess, and there's gaps in your defenses so wide I could march elephants through," Stannis said, blunt and implacable. Rob had hard work to take it without letting his temper rise, but it was work he had to do, because Stannis was right. He'd known it himself, but he'd also known there wasn't anything better he could do. "It's got to be fixed," Stannis continued. "And if we have less than 2 months left, it's got to be fixed faster than you'll be able to do it. But not faster than I can. And at the end of the day, what matters is whether we win. Not if we win the same way men did 1,000 years ago.
Rob drew a deep breath and let it out again before he could let himself answer.
"I don't dispute what you said, any part of it," he said. "And if this were another war, I'd be a fool not to give way to you. But this isn't an ordinary war. And what I do know is that when this war has been won before, it's a Stark who's led the way each time. That we are called to the work, and you aren't."
"Don't be so certain of that,"
the red-robed woman behind Stannis put in, and Stannis turned and beckoned her forward.
"This is Lady Melisandre of Ashai," he said. "A red priestess of the Lord of the Light. She has magic of her own. True powers, that I've seen with my own eyes. She's come to help as well."
"Has she?" Rob said grimly. "There are some dark stories told of the Red Priestesses."
The woman smiled a little.
"Many men fear that which they don't understand, Lord Stark. And still more do they fear a power they cannot control. But the Lord I serve is the protector of the living world, and he holds his hand over those who will shelter beneath it."
"You should know it was her council that decided our coming," Stannis added. "I thought first to send Sir Davos," he indicated the bearded knight to his other side, who jerked his head in a nod to them, "with the dragonglass, to see what was going on up here. Lady Melisandre looked into the flames and told me that if we didn't all go, and now we'd be too late. And she had to go herself, even if none of the rest of us did.
Rob looked at her, startled, and she said, I have seen myself upon the wall, Lord Stark.
She turned and pointed up at the towering height of the wall, to the guard station there far above.
I was there, and the sky was dark, though it was the hour of noon, and below me, on the ground, a great mass of darkness gathered upon the earth. And in the vision I called out to the Lord and stretched forth my hand, and in the midst of that darkness an arrow of flame came alight, cleaving through it.
She pointed to the narrow wedge between the pebbles.
I am certain that the Lord of Light will give his blessing to this army and see us to victory, but it must be his chosen one who leads it, and that, I believe, is Lord Stannis.
If the Lord of Light wants to aid us, I'll take his aid and yours, Rob said, but not your conditions. Our own gods have been good enough to see us through this war before, and I'm not inclined to trade them in for yours unproven. I'm truly sorry, my lord, he added to Stannis. I know to you this may seem like a foolish boy's pride. I beg you to believe that it's not. I've no pride that I'd put before victory in this cause.
Stannis looked at him, flicked his head a little, with a small grimace.
All right. I'm sorry it's got to be done this way. He gave a sharp nod to the men behind him, and Rob had a blank moment of horror. Another thing it hadn't occurred to him to fear. Any man whose sword comes out of his sheath dies. Brienne's voice, crisp and cold, sounded from above, and Rob jerked his gaze upward to see her standing on the upper walkway of the courtyard alongside 10 of the archers, all of them with bows drawn on Stannis and his men. Stand them down, Lord Stannis, or I'll drop you myself. Rob had a burst of shocked relief. He had no idea how Brienne had known to be wary of such a thing. And then Lord Tyrion emerged onto the walkway and said, Lord Stannis, it's good to see you again. I see the years haven't changed you. He came down the stairs from the walkway to the yard, smiling broad and pleasant at Stannis, as though there weren't any threat of arms at work.
I'm surprised to see you here, Lord Tyrion, Stannis said coldly. Your sisters persuaded Robert to neglect his duty. Your brother's raising an army to march on the north.
Well, I've always liked to think of myself as the cleverest of the family, Tyrion said. Speaking of which, I'd like to suggest to you both that it's not truly worth quarreling over technicalities. In practice, once the fighting is actually happening, there's not going to be time for orders to go back and forth between the wall and the field. We're going to need both of you to command. Lord Stannis, I think we can safely agree that you're the man to take charge of the defenses of the keeps, which would free Lord Stark to lead those sorties against the enemy.
He gestured to the arrow point of twigs.
And as for our preparations, well, you approve of Lord Stark's plan of battle. He agrees with all your criticism of our defenses. As far as I can see, the two of you don't seem to have any disagreements at all so far. Why don't we wait to fight over them until you do? And if we do all make it through this alive, which your arrival has just made much more likely, it will be just as well that the two of you do so amicably. It's already going to be an uphill climb trying to convince Robert that we're not all traitors.
Whether or not he was persuaded, Stannis did stand down, and he allowed himself and his red-robed witch to be shown to quarters by a couple of the stewards that Tyrion had brought along. As they went, the woman casting a final look over at them with strange intentness in her bird-bright eyes, Rob breathed again, though not easily.
I'm grateful, he said to Tyrion somberly, but I fear we've not reached the end of that trouble.
We'll have 10 men on you at all times, Brienne said fiercely, and Rob shook his head helplessly. He couldn't be thinking of a knife in his back every hour of the day and still do the work he needed to do.
Precautions never go amiss, but I do think this is a problem that will be amenable to another kind of solution, Tyrion said. Tonight at dinner, as the news about Winterfell spreads, Jory should rise and suggest to you that as Warden of the North, you formally charge King Robert with breaking his oath as protector of the realm by refusing to come to your aid.
Rob stared at him.
What good would that do? But to make the king twice as angry as he already is, he might hurt my father or Bran.
You can give exactly that answer, Tyrion said, and refuse to even worry about such a thing when we have a war against the dead to fight. But you can make quite clear that your sentiments lie entirely in that direction, and would require only very little nudging. Because if Robert is an oathbreaker and a false king, Rob said slowly, beginning to understand, then Stannis would be king in his stead?
Exactly, Tyrion said, and as king, could naturally do a great deal to spread the worship of the Lord of the Light, which I'm sure would sway the feelings of his very dramatically gowned counselor. But Stannis can't make that accusation himself. Apart from how it would look, he's not one of the appointed wardens. You are, since Robert swore you into the post when he took your father south. Dangle that bait for Stannis, and I think he'll suddenly discover a great deal of tolerance for shared command. You might also ask after the health of his daughter, Tyrion added.
Lady Shireen? Rob said, bewildered.
His only child and sole heiress, Tyrion said, and not even 6 years younger than you. She'll be of marriageable age before you know it. And a little bird has whispered to me that Lady Marjorie Tyrell has married Prince Joffrey back in King's Landing, which means that you are now once again on the market yourself. It's quite irresistible, really. It all makes such a neat, tidy arrangement.
Rob had to fight to quash his own sharp swell of anger. He knew Tyrion was right, and he had to be grateful for the advice, but it soured his stomach to pretend that he'd connived a plot to take the Iron Throne for the greed of having it in his own turn. It felt as if he could make King Robert's insults and accusations true, and worse, that he had to do it just so that Lord Stannis didn't try to stab him in the back, preferring to do it to his own brother. But with that thought, anger sank away, back into fear, and Rob put his hand over his face and reached the other to John, who came and put his arms around him and buried his face against Rob's shoulder. The two of them clenched together with shared grief for their own brother, their little brother, in the hands of traitors.